Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is the awesome Kristen Berman, CEO and co-founder of Irrational Labs. We're going to talk about behavioral economics today. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, great to be here. Excited for this chat.
We're absolutely thrilled. But for those listeners who don't know you, could you give us a bit of overview what you do and what your background story is?
For sure. Yes. So I'm a behavioral scientist, which means I think about why people do what they do. And I have a co-founder and CEO of a company called Irrational Labs. And so we work with organizations to implement behavioral insights into the core of their product design and their marketing growth. And my background story is I was a product manager at Intuit over 10 years ago, working to build Quicken Online, if you remember, in the personal financial space. Quicken was all the rage. And we were in a fight with Mint. And Mint, you know, obviously won. But at that time, we were really working to improve the product. And as a PM there, we were looking for hacks to figure out what to do. And we built something that we thought people would love. And we spent so much time on it. And when we brought them into the lab, and Intuit has this really fun lab where you can look at people as they go through your product, we realized that people actually were covering their eyes when they saw what we built. And this was terrifying to us after working so hard. And the question was, why? And, you know, it's personal financial management, and people were actually seeing their finances displayed beautifully. Like, the designers we had on the team were wonderful, amazing designers, and they displayed someone spending in a beautiful pie chart, and people would cover their eyes. And as a product manager, the real question was, what is going on here? What is happening? But as a behavioral scientist, I know, and I would have known back then. And so what was happening is something called information aversion, where you just don't really want to see. If you step on the scale and it's too much, you're not going to step on the scale again. If you look at your bank account and it's in the red, you're just not going to want to look. And we built something that was the equivalent of a scale to people, and you just don't want to look. And so as a product manager, man, I wish I had had that behavioral science toolkit at that time to really understand what was going on. And so now I met Dan Ariely, who's a behavioral economist, trained under him. And now I'm working to bring the behavioral science toolkit to designers, to PMs, to marketers, to really help people uncover what kind of those motivations, those underlying motivations are that maybe are hard to describe when you interview customers, but drive our behavior on a daily basis.
How large is your team, and what does your daily work life look like? You know, do you do training? Do you do hands-on consulting?
We're a small team. So we have 5 full-time folks and an army of part-time behavioral scientists that work with us. And every day we get to think about pretty hard problems. So we're thinking about how you get people to go to the doctor. And we're working with One Medical to design different ways to do this. We're working with Intuit to think about, and kind of my past, bringing back some of my past, but to think about financial behavior as well. We're working with an insurance provider to think about other ways to drive healthy behaviors. So we get to think about these hard problems and then partner with the PM and the marketer and the designer to actually bring some solutions that we hope will work, and then we measure impact to life.
I'm curious, what stage of product development do these companies bring you at? Is it usually the conception of the product, or like they build something, it didn't work, and then they come to you?
Great question. Yeah, so there's usually three ways that behavioral economics can be helpful to companies. And one we think is really kind of after, and really what is behavioral economics is kind of known for is after a product may have launched, how do you use small nudges to help drive behavior. And this could look like, you know, adding social proof to something. It could look like small friction reductions where you look at a signup flow and you remove the things that are barriers to conversion. So that's kind of one way. And that's after a product is launched, we help people improve it. Another way is really in the beginning stages, where we want to think about what is the core value of a product or service. And how do we build it knowing a user's psychology? And I briefly mentioned that Dan Ariely had developed a scale. And this is actually a nice example of how you insert behavioral science into a core of a product, where the scale doesn't actually show you your weight. And this goes back to this information aversion concept, is people don't step on the scale because you don't want to see your weight. And so this scale doesn't show you your weight. It only shows you your weight if you actually have fluctuated. And what do I mean by that? Most of the time when you step on the scale, you're getting an interesting feedback. It could go up or down a pound, but that doesn't relate to what you ate yesterday. And in behavioral science, we know that feedback matters. And so if you ate a salad and the scale goes up, this is sad and you probably won't step on the scale again. And so instead, the scale is built to give you rewards for doing things that would relate to future weight loss. So if you go for a walk or you eat something good, you tell the app and it gives you some points and it gives you some feedback. And then only when your weight has actually changed does it let you know that. So, you know, and the scale has been shown to work in that most of the time as we age, this is a sad reality for people, but most of the time we actually gain weight. So on average, we are gaining weight. And so the scale actually prevents us from gaining weight. So it helps us. It's so a little bit of weight loss, but mostly just preventing us from gaining it. By the way, if you step on the scale in the beginning of the day, you think more deeply about your eating behavior. And so the scale also motivates you to step on it in the beginning of the day, because if you step on it at the end, the day's almost done and not much you can do. So in general, you know, why that's interesting, it's like you wouldn't really have thought to build a scale like this without knowing some of the core motivations of human psychology. And so behavioral science is helpful kind of as the magic dust that you can sprinkle on a product to drive engagement and growth, but it's also helpful in the very beginning stages where you're thinking about designing products and features.
Let us step back a little bit and define behavioral economics as it is. What's the difference between behavioral economics and behavioral science? And how do they help us?
Yeah. So actually, let's start with what's the difference between economics and behavioral economics. And so kind of typically, people had thought about humans for a very long time as just responding to the supply and demand curve. You know, we really would look at price and time and utility. And if something changed, we would make a rational decision that would reflect our preferences. And behavioral science, and by the way, pausing. I use behavioral science and behavioral economics as interchangeable, and I think that's how we should think about them. In the technical sense, behavioral economics is a field of study in the academic world. Behavioral science tends to be used as a word more for application, but they mean the same theory, which is basically a reaction to the economics curve and the idea that humans are just behaving like Spock in a very rational, calculated manner. In the economic world, you would go into a coffee shop and you'd look at the amount of money you'd spend on coffee and you'd say, is this correct? Should I be spending $3 on coffee or should I be investing it in the market? Should I be spending $3 on coffee or should I be spending it later in the evening? And obviously, people just don't do this. And so when we study human behavior, we study what people do instead. And what people do instead is we take mental shortcuts. We think about the value of the opportunity cost potentially of the next thing that we would be doing, not the very far in the future. We may look and see if there's a long line, and if there's a long line, that may actually get us to go to that coffee shop more because it's a popular coffee shop. And we don't actually care about the waiting as much as we do about the social proof that other people are going there. And so we take these shortcuts all the time, and behavioral economics studies these types of shortcuts and the underlying psychology that they bring.
Is there a list of most popular shortcuts, like behavior patterns that we fall into unconsciously or consciously?
So I think if you were to look at the Wikipedia for a list of biases, there's over like 200 biases. And there's now an app called, you know, OpenAI, where you could probably create your own biases based on AI. But so it could be limitless. Humans are fallible in many ways. For Rational Labs, we've simplified the world into what we say this 3B framework is: you pick a behavior that you want somebody to do, yourself to do, or your consumers to do. You reduce the barriers to that behavior. So this is reducing friction, the cognitive overload, making choices easier, and you increase the immediate benefits. And when I say benefits, I mean immediate. and humans, we are present bias. And so we over-prioritize the present moment more than we likely should. So this is, I will, even though I'm on a diet, I may eat the muffin. Even though I may have an early presentation, I may stay up and watch a show of Netflix. And so we, you know, and obviously if you've ever logged into TikTok, you know that you are present bias where you may stay on TikTok too long for what you had normally intended. And so for what that means for designing products is that we want to make something immediately gratifying to overcome, you know, to help us actually take action in the moment.
What do we do as creators of boring B2B applications where, you know, success implies hard work and things like that? And shall we do like a waving paperclip in the corner that says like, you're great as the reward? Like, what can we even do?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of it's nice to think about like, what are the creative rewards that you can give people immediately? I think what we should do is build products that assume that people have lots on their mind, their attention is not solely on us, and that the idea of being better in the future may not motivate me to take action. And so when you build a product with that in mind, it's very easy to get creative then. You say, well, what would help me take action today? I'll give you a small example. We worked with a company that was trying to get some marketing managers to do something that was difficult for them for confidentiality. I won't say what, but we had to motivate them. The company said, we're willing to give $100. So we said, okay, we'll give a $50 credit to the product. We'll give $100 credit to the product. And maybe people are motivated by more than just money. So why don't we also try one condition where we give them a free movie, where we'll give them a gift certificate to get a movie. And maybe after a long day of work, they get to sit back, relax, and watch this movie. Obviously, the movie is less of a value than the credit was at $50 or $100. And the movie credit actually motivated more people to take the intended action than the monetary incentive. And what this implies is that even if you're designing a product for business people, they are still human. They still want to go home and maybe relax. And so even if it's a B2B product, the end consumer may still take, you know, has the motivation of immediate benefits as well.
How about the classic theory? I read the book, the classic one, Why We Do What We Do. And there's a whole chapter on how rewards actually decrease motivation because now from being internally motivated, people become externally motivated. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think for the most part, that can be true. So one general lesson in behavioral science is that it's very context dependent. And so there's no real one rule. We wish there was one rule for everything. But for sure, we are motivated by more than money. And when you try to insert money into some places, it could be almost offensive. If you think about kind of the hard things we're willing to do without money, it's very clear that money is not the only motivator. We hike up large mountains, we run marathons, we do art projects. If you've ever, maybe people have been to Burning Man, people spend the full year creating art projects just in preparation for this 1 week of an event. Nobody pays them to do this. There's some grant funding out there, but nobody really pays most of the people to do this. And so the motivation there is an internal drive. And so you can imagine if somebody was maybe running a marathon, you say, okay, I'll pay you $50 to run the marathon. Obviously, this would be offensive. You say, one, it's gonna cost you wildly more than $50 if you want me to run the marathon. I'm offended that you'd think I'd do this for $50. And so as soon as you start inserting money into something that could have an internal drive, it could definitely backfire. Now, does that mean that money doesn't ever work? You know, obviously credit card companies, they incentivize us. I think the latest offer I got from Chase was like, I'll pay you $300 to switch to my credit card. And so there can be an initial spike. Monetary incentives can be and have been shown to be okay for getting people over the hump of starting. But when you think about using them for an ongoing behavior and for something that you want people to do on a regular basis, you know, unless you're Google and you have lots and lots of money, this is very difficult. So we would not try to incentivize people with money on an ongoing basis, but to get people over a hump of starting something could be very interesting. And of course, would try to separate the idea of money from social norms. We don't think people should be paying their friends to hang out with them, and we shouldn't be paying, you know, our users to use our product either.
You have a gigantic library of successful case studies. And are there any of them that you could share with our audience?
Sure. Yeah. First, I'll mention this, a general kind of underlying principle of behavioral science, which is we did a quantitative study where we asked people who, you know, if they need help taking their medication. And these, we screened out for people who had some illness, and we said, you have high blood pressure. Do you need help taking the medication? And, oh, by the way, if you fail to take the medication, there's a high risk of stroke. And the majority of people told us they do not need any help in taking their medication. And the question here is that true? And it turns out, especially for hypertension, and hypertension is just high blood pressure, that within a year, half the people who are prescribed this hypertension medication stop taking it completely. So people may say that they don't need any help, but in reality, they may need some help. And this is really what we think about the say-do ratio, is that people, when we're interviewing them or talking to them, it's very easy to say that we're going to do something, say that we care about something. But in behavioral science, we study what people actually do. And this helps us with understanding why somebody is taking any action. I'll give you an example. We worked with a company called Steady, which is a fintech app, and they help people get kind of gig economy style jobs. And as part of this, they offer a very lovely income tracker. So if you have a variable job, it's quite likely that you would want to see your income on a weekly or monthly basis, because it goes up and down. But in order to see your income, you have to do something difficult. You have to sync your bank account. You have to put in your username and your password, and then you get to see your income. And if you design a product, you know that those types of things are moments where people drop off. They say goodbye. And so, you know, if you were just to ask somebody, are you interested in this feature? Do you want to use it? Why aren't you using it? They may give you some really reasonable answers. They may say things like, of course I want to use it, you know, but it doesn't have this one feature that would be very valuable. Or of course I want to use it, and this is kind of the perfect thing for me. But when you look at their drop-off rates, it was like, wow, this is not working out well. So one assumption is you should, as a product team, change the feature. You should build something that people want, and you've obviously gotten it wrong. As behavioral scientists, our approach is to look at that every single step somebody takes to get to the behavior that we want them to get to. And so by doing that, what we realized is that moment where you're syncing your bank account had too much friction and not enough kind of immediate motivation for somebody to get over that hump. It goes back to that barriers and benefits thing. And so the question was, we can't reduce the barriers to doing that, but how do we increase the immediate motivation? And so we did a very simple change, which is we changed the choice architecture. And so instead of saying, do you want to sync your bank account? Let's go. Or I think it was let's go, but equivalent to a continue. We said, this is a feature. Do you want to accept or decline the feature? Now, in this moment, you basically have a decision to make. Are you going to forever say no to this feature and move on with your life, but it seems like never get a chance to correct your opinion? Or are you going to accept it? And if you accept it, you continue. And so by changing the choice architecture this way, you know, obviously these are just small buttons, but we changed the mental model of the feature. And it went from the people who continue, it went from 35% to 65% of people who clicked to accept the feature. And then obviously there's a lot of hurdles in between accepting and actually completing. And from that, we went from a 7% to a 12% bump in the people who completed the flow. By the way, we had another condition that worked even more. I can talk about that in a minute. But in general, our line of thinking in behavioral science is around not just asking people what they about their opinion on something, but really studying the small details of the product flow to design something that we think will help people overcome the barriers.
In retrospect, that of course looks magical, but what is your flow for achieving such magical solutions? Do you just come up with like a dozen hypotheses that could work and test them, or is there anything that shortens the process.
Yeah. Our first step as behavioral scientists is to do a behavioral map, which is map out every single step it takes somebody to get to the behavior. When we do that with teams, and we do these big workshops where we co-collaborate and everyone maps out the steps. And by the way, this is not necessarily a journey map that people think of. I think journey maps are pretty high level and talk about emotions. These are fine, but for us, we care about every single field somebody must enter. We don't care about the high level idea of the step. And when you think about every single field somebody must enter, it all of a sudden becomes clear how much work goes into the thing you're asking somebody to do. So as a very basic level, we take a magnifying glass to the environment, the context of the decision that people are making. This gets us half the way there, where you don't have to be a behavioral scientist to look at that and say, wow, there's a lot of opportunity. And then as a second step, we look at the psychologies that are driving people at every single step. And so, you know, these could be things like optimism bias. By the way, optimism bias is especially important in health. We all think we're not going to get sick. Very difficult. We think about norms. What are other people doing at this time? And in situations of high complexity, we look to norms especially. And by the way, most startups, you know, we have no idea what they are. We're evaluating a startup and there's a high uncertain and probably complex decision to make. And so norms are very helpful. So we look at these psychologies and we pair them up with the step that we're asking people to do. And then you kind of mix some art and science and you say, what is the most important step here? And what is the most important psychology? I think these things, it can become very obvious with data. You know, you look at the biggest drop-off rate within some flow and you say, this is obviously where we should focus. And you can start thinking about, are there norms? Or do we have we reduced the barriers? Have we increased the benefits? So there's some art and some science, but really it's about mapping the environment and laying over the psychologies that's driving people.
As we have been focusing for ages on user onboarding at UseList, which is the product we run together with my co-founder, we have, you know, there is always this balance between front-loading the work for the user so that they can have a successful experience afterwards, so that, for example, you can make the onboarding just a slight tidbit longer, but then they will have, you know, don't have to go to settings to customize it, which they have low chances of finding, et cetera, et cetera. Or you can optimize it for, you know, making the sign up happen, like two fields, like goodbye, but then whatever happens next is less successful. How do we balance like different benefits received on different steps of this life cycle journey?
It's a great question, because as a mantra, kind of as behavioral scientists, we say reduce the friction. And yet that kind of pushes the problem somewhere else, right? It pushes it mm-hmm. later in the flow. We really like actually onboarding that creates the mental model of the product. So the interesting thing about onboarding is that there will never be a time where your user is more motivated to use your product. Every single day after, they either forget about you or they just say, maybe I won't use it today. And it's much more of a rational decision. Do I use or not use? Versus at the point that they're already in your signup flow, a lot has had to happen to get them there. So at some level, this is your job, is to create the mental model of how you want people to use it in the future at the point that they're starting with you. So, and this becomes much more feasible to do if the signup flow is much more required. So, you know, in health insurance, you just have to sign up for health insurance. And so you can make, actually, I think insurance companies should make the sign-up flow pretty long, because they can teach you things, they can set up settings, they can set your pharmacy, they could set your provider. There's lots of things you're willing to do because this is insurance. You just have to sign up. And people understand that this is not a flow that they can exit without activating. If it's a product that's optional, this is tough, because people now have a decision of, are you going to give up or are you going to continue? And so for us at that point, then it becomes a little bit more about highlighting the benefits of a flow. So you can imagine a world where we work with fintech apps and you can say, at some level, we have these features. Let's say it's bill pay. We could just tell them about bill pay, right? We could say, here, we have this wonderful feature called bill pay. We can pay your bills weekly or monthly, or I'm making some daily. There should be a fintech app that pays your bills daily. But you could tell people about it, or you could ask them a question of how many bills do you want us to pay for you? And at this point, you're basically exposing a feature that you have by creating a moment in the onboarding that lets people do a setting. And so you, by asking a question, you can expose a benefit and the mental model of what you're doing. ClassPass does this very nicely. They say, what type of class do you want? And they give you a full list of classes. And the idea here is that they're exposing all the things that you could do when you're starting with ClassPass. So TLDR, our point of view is if you're going to ask people questions, make sure the questions are creating a mental model for the product and driving home the main benefit of the product. By the way, also Thumbtack does this very well, where they ask you lots of questions about what type of services you want from Thumbtack. Their sign up flow exposes benefits in a really lovely way.
This is a really good lesson for the product owners who are listening to us. How do we illustrate the benefits? Well, I can totally see how that can be done via the product mechanics where you can, you know, show some choices or anything. But if that's not obvious how to do this, do you have like sidebar with people's quotes or like happy people faces or whatever, you know, the cheesy best practice is there that we can see almost everywhere, unfortunately?
I'm not a big fan of just telling people about something. I think the effect just doesn't last that long. One finding that behavioral science has been quite robust in is that information by itself doesn't drive our behavior. So if I tell you about, if I tell you the calories in something, you will likely, you may in the moment still eat it. In fact, calorie labels have not driven down our calorie intake, even though it may seem like that in the moment. By and large, calorie labels have not worked, which is shocking and very sad. And so we should be very skeptical about our efforts to tell people things and as it relates to their actual engagement. So if that's your only bullet that you can fire is you know, some text, I think things like social proof and testimonials that say how other people have used and found the product successful are probably the best bet, because at that point you're just giving someone confidence and certainty that this is the right decision that they're making to use and engage with the product. But at a level of trying to tell people about a future feature, we're very busy. We lack attention. If something takes an action, we're not going to remember to do it. So if anything, we'd put it more into the just-in-time education thing. As soon as you want somebody to do something, you tell them to do it. This is going to be much more effective than a carousel screen with small dots under it.
Let's say a product owner is listening to us and they have a product that requires behavior change. I know, medicine reminder app, something that's relevant to exercise, weight loss, well, the classic ones, anything else that requires consistent effort. And we know that's the hardest effort to ask for. What are the classic measures that behavioral science can offer?
Yeah, I think the idea of this behavioral map is quite useful. We put it under a process called behavioral design. So the quick is you do this map, you layer on the psychologies, and then you do an experiment. But the idea here is that you're deeply studying the environment of decision making that someone's going through. And the map really has you call out all the assumptions that you're making about them. Like if you're asking someone to do something on a daily basis, what are they not doing because of it? How much work are they putting into it? Have they told anybody else that they're doing this behavior? What is the benefit that they get from doing it? Have they created a time and a place in their mind yet to do it? The map really helps outline these assumptions. It says, in order to get me to take my medicine every day, I have to pick it up from the pharmacy. I have to, you know, put it out. I have to have water by my bed. All these things are trivial by themselves, but together it's a big assumption. And so, you know, I think one of the best things that's happened to medicine are things like the IUD, where we're just saying, just build a product that you don't need to take every day. So birth control is like, take it every day at the same time, very difficult and very ineffective. You know, if you look at the stats for birth control in an oral way, it's just not great. And the IUD is basically, I think, one of the better behavioral solutions out there, where you say, just do a hard thing one time, which is, you know, put it in and then you're good. It's beautiful. And so the question on getting someone to do something every day, if you can we get them to make a one-time decision now that would lock them into to a future outcome. I'll tell you another idea here is if you say, I want to get somebody to walk every day. Very difficult, right? But possible. You could send them notifications. You could ask them to create an implementation commitment, which is, kind of a pre-commitment to what they're going to do and when. You could tell them everybody else is doing it. You could ask them to read a book. Lots of things you could do. You could also try to convince them to buy a dog. At this point,
I saw that coming. Yes.
Yeah. At this point, you basically are now locked into walking every day. And so I think these are the types of solutions that product managers should look for, of trying to figure out how you can motivate the behavior you're looking to motivate, but instead of trying to get me to do something every day, you get me to do maybe one hard thing that's made it easy for the rest of the time.
Is it because done for you paid like concierge setup might be a better solution? So you like ask people for have to bill upfront and then you do the work together because they committed for something big?
Yeah, I think concierge setup, I think that's what you said, right? Is concierge setup. Yeah, I think this is really lovely that the idea that you will in the beginning spend some time together getting you set up right, creating a mental model for how to use the product, putting some effort into it. By the way, effort in general, again, as we said, there's, if you reduce all friction, maybe this is the magical default experience, but if you add some effort and people are doing some work, they may value it more. And so concierge service is quite nice because you're helping them, but they're also going to be a part of it. It creates a time and a place to do something. So, the idea that people would like, all these smart devices that are, you have to download the app and then you have to pair the device and then you have to do the settings to do your alerts. It's like, these are things a small percentage of people will do very well and a large percentage of people will forget and do later.
How about behaviors that we don't want to happen? Like quitting smoking.
Yeah, quitting smoking is an interesting one. I think in one world, we should just mandate that no one can smoke. So, and because we can't, then we end up doing things like taxes and we end up doing things like telling people they can't smoke inside. But at some level, that smoking has a negative externality on health. And for those negative externalities, this is kind of a philosophical idea, but you can regulate negative externalities that hurt other people. That said, the storyline in smoking is quite interesting in that one of the anecdotes as to why smoking has gone down is the campaign for secondhand smoke. Like, imagine a child walking by you when you're smoking, you are killing that child. and then you feel bad and people don't want you to kill that child. And so now all of a sudden we say you have to smoke outside and you can't smoke in the office. And so creating kind of that idea that secondhand smoke is, and by the way, secondhand smoke is not actually that bad, but it's been made out to be very bad and it's quite work to drive down smoking rates. Some taxes have also worked. Making people go outside has also worked. Things that have not worked are billboards. So some anecdotes from Australia research is if you put a billboard outside and you remind people not to smoke, that's actually a great cue for
smoking. Like, let's smoke.
Go get cigarettes. So that's a great reminder. I don't have cigarettes. Maybe I'll go get them. So this is the idea also of information not working to change behavior, and that if you just give people information about smoking, this still doesn't stop me from lighting up. By the way, Juul is not bad either. I think Juul is still, we can, it has obviously all these negative effects on children and teens, but unarguably a very good option for people to stop smoking. And so if it didn't have the negative effects on teens and children and getting people who maybe weren't smoking to start Juul, this would be the savior of the US, at least for getting people to stop smoking.
It sounded almost like you're going to follow up with an affiliate link for that.
No, I mean, I think by and large, the negative effects Juul has are likely, over time going to be worse. But just taking it in isolation, it's basically like, how do you get somebody to turn to a vegetarian? Somebody who eats meat. We could try to convince them. We could try to do programs. Or you could make impossible burgers or Beyond Meat And now you have something that tastes a lot like meat that people are going to be using as an alternative that is close, and they aren't making a trade-off between, you know, between doing eating a salad and eating a burger. They're making a trade-off between eating something that tastes very good to something that tastes very good as well. And I think that's a little bit what Juul has done, is like, we're not asking people to completely quit smoking. They're just doing something that's less bad. By the way, smoking is still the number one killer. So this is, you know, this is very bad, smoking. And so I think, or actually heart disease and then smoking. So I think people forget how bad smoking is because most of us have stopped, but it is still a problem to solve.
Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah.
As we're wrapping up today's episode, what are some great reading resources out there that can help people, you know, acquire that knowledge that will help them with their own products?
Great question. So the self-promotional plug is that we have our behavioral economics boot camp, which is an 8-week self-paced course. You know, there's an intro call where you meet other people, and we have a very active Slack group, and we have office hour. But it's really about kind of deepening your knowledge about what are the psychologies that are driving consumers, and then giving you the tools to do the behavioral diagnosis and do the behavioral tools. So literature review, experimentation, tons of content. So I would say if you're interested, that's probably a place to dip your toe. Otherwise, you know, getting a PhD is much longer and difficult. So
anything that requires less commitment, such as a book, maybe a blog or something.
Yeah. So I would say probably just reading A Predictably Irrational, which is Dan Ariely's first book. You know, Irrational Labs does a newsletter, and we publish them. We do summaries of academic papers, so you can kind of get your feet wet there, and we tell you what's going on in the behavioral science world. I would say probably The Predictably Irrational is a great place to start. People also like Influence by Cialdini, and he just came out with an updated version of that. Those would be the places to start.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. I've also heard you have a discount code for our listeners for the bootcamp,
yes.
Right?
So a 20% UI breakfast so you get 20% off, and the code is UI breakfast.
Fantastic.
I'm sure maybe there's some show notes, but it's bebootcamp.com, or just go to the Irrational Labs site and you'll get connected to the bootcamp.
Fantastic. Where can people find you personally online, on social media, etc.?
Yeah, most often on Twitter. So Bermster, Bermster, Bermster on Twitter is the most likely place. But I do, you know, this is the IKEA effect where we value more what we make, but that Irrational Labs newsletter, we really like it. It's a great place for people to kind of read some academic articles and know what's going on in the field.
Thanks so much, Kristen, for sharing your wisdom today. It was a wonderful sneak peek into this amazing, beautiful industry that you run. And thanks so much once again for great advice.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Jane.